Welcome. We're very glad to see each of you here. I want to welcome our friends who are part of our extended Bible study time on Facebook and maybe some of the other social media outlets to our Tuesday night Bible study. Now we're going through the book of Genesis, and tonight brings us to chapter 15 of Genesis. And this is a story, we just had our prayer before we began, so you can pray in your homes if you're watching. And we're going to launch into verse 1. Now, God willing, I'm hoping to get through Genesis 15 and 16. And so let me do some reading here. We'll pause and do our best to unpack what we're looking at. Verse 1, Genesis 15. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in vision, saying, "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield and your exceedingly great reward." Now, why did God have to tell Abraham, his name is Abram at this point, not to be afraid? I'm your shield. What had happened in the previous chapter? Do you remember? That five Assyrian kings developed a confederacy. They came down and they kidnapped Lot. They destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah and four of the cities of the plain. They carried off Lot and his family. Abraham, in a confederacy with Mamre and I can't remember the other one. The three of the big tribes there, and Abraham, they put all their tribes together. They went and they pursued and attacked these kings from Damascus, terribly defeated them, rescued Lot. Now Abraham's thinking, you know, that was a divine victory, just a few. Abraham had 300 men in his personal army. A few compared to the thousands that were coming from the north, he thought, you know, they may get back together again and come after me. So he's wondering now if they could expect years of war. And God is saying, don't be afraid. I am your shield. I will protect you during this time. But then Abraham goes on, and he's thinking about the real desire in his heart. He still has no child. Verse 2, but Abram says, "Lord, what will you give me, seeing I go childless? And the heir of my house is this Eliezer of Damascus." Now, Eliezer, where do you find him appearing significantly in Genesis a little later? When the time comes for Abraham to find a wife for Isaac, this is years later, who does he call upon to be the one to pick a bride? Is Eliezer. Eliezer must have been a real man of integrity. You listen to the times when Eliezer talks, and he always refers to Abraham, my master. He was a very humble servant, very wise, very dedicated. And you think about it, he stood in line to inherit everything that Abraham had. And yet he was so happy when Abraham had a son, and now everything was going to go to the son. But Eliezer evidently had been in the household of Abraham many years and had been born from probably one of Abraham's slaves in his household. And sometimes it wasn't uncommon for people to sort of adopt people that had grown up in their house and say, look, I have no normal heir, but since I've known you since a baby, I'm going to write you up as my heir. And so he's thinking, you know, the only one I have is Eliezer. He's been like a son from Damascus. He was born in my house from a baby on up. And then God says to him, and he said, I go childless. The heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. Then Abraham said, look, you've given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this one shall not be your heir, but one who shall come from your own body shall be your heir. Whereas Eliezer would have been adopted. He said, no, it's going to be physically from your own seed. Then he brought him outside. Now, what does that imply? He'd been in a tent. And he said, now look towards the heaven and count the stars if you're able to number them. He said to him, so shall your descendants be. And this is one of the great verses, verse 16. Now, I just want to pause before I tell you about verse 16. Earlier in verse 13, yeah, sorry. In chapter 13, my mind was somewhere else. In chapter 13, he says to Abraham, go out and look abroad to the north, the south, the east, and the west. It was daytime, and he's looking horizontally. Now he's renewing the covenant. He's saying, I want you to go out at night, and I want you to look up. I want you to look vertically. So basically, at some point between these two chapters, he's telling Abraham, you know, you've got your earthly promise, but the most important thing is I want you to look up the heavenly promise. And he said, your seed will be greater than the stars of heaven. Now, have you ever seen any of the seed of Abraham? Look at the person to your right or to your left. If they are a Christian, what does the Bible say? If you are Christ's, then you are Abraham's seed. So, what does it mean to be of the seed of Abraham? This is not a popular study because right now we're living in an age where everybody is talking about, you know, the importance of Israel, and we're very passionate about that. But I think you've got to be biblically accurate that all the promises God made to Israel belong to any believer. You can't be literally nationalistic as a Christian and say all of it has to do with the territory over there that's smaller than California. Really, the promises to Abraham, he said it's going to be like the stars of heaven. Jesus said to the religious leaders, they said, we've never been servants of any man. Abraham's our father. And Jesus said, whoever sins is a slave of sin. You are of your father, the devil. They said, no, we're Abraham's children. Jesus said, no, you're not. And then Jesus said, many will come from the east and the west and sit down in the kingdom with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the natural children will be in outer darkness. So God has never said someone is saved based upon being physically related to Abraham. I think we all know in the Old Testament there were people that were saved, that were faithful, and there were people that were Jews, but they were not faithful, and they were not saved. So God is always, he's never been a respecter of persons. He doesn't save anyone based on their DNA. So being a child of Abraham spiritually, what's more important, being a physical son of Abraham or a spiritual son of Abraham? Which one gives you eternal life? Yeah, so when he said, he looked up and he said, your descendants will be more than the stars of heaven. Now, that's an example of what you call hyperbole. Back when, back in the days of Galileo, they thought they had counted 5,112 stars. Well, you know, he had the first primitive telescope, and you couldn't see that many, and they'd sectioned off the sky, and they strained their eyes, and they did their best to count, and they came up with, and that's the northern hemisphere, what they could see was, you know, 5,112 or something. But God said that the stars are like the sand of the sea. Now, you want to hear an interesting fact is that astronomers now believe there are approximately as many stars, not counting planets, there are approximately as many stars in the cosmos as there are grains of sand in the world. And then that's not hyperbole. They're not exaggerating. Can you imagine that? And so, you know, when God said, he didn't mean there's going to be 20 billion, zillion, gazillion, you know, descendants. He was speaking in, you can't number the stars, you can't number how many your seed are going to be. And certainly that is true today. So then the wonderful verse is verse 6. And it says, he believed the Lord, and he accounted it to him for righteousness. Now, I don't know if you underline in your Bible, but if you do, that's one you might want to underline. Because that verse is a foundational verse that is always used in the New Testament and even in the Old Testament for what you call righteousness by faith. Abraham believed and he was declared righteous based upon his faith. God made a promise, he believed the promise, and God credited him with righteousness because of his faith. And as children of Abraham, we are declared righteous based on our faith. Now, is it the faith that we're going to have offspring? Is it the faith that we're going to multiply? No, it's a faith that through Christ, we can be declared righteous. We can be saved from the power of sin. See, and in the context of this whole story, you remember what we start out with in chapter 15? Abraham is concerned about the enemies attacking him. And God said, I am your shield. In this same vision, he said, you are declared righteous by faith. We are saved. Christ is our shield from the enemy. And we are declared righteous by faith. Then he said, verse 7, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to inherit it. Now, that word Chaldean, that appears, here we are in Genesis 15, that appears a lot in the Bible. That's really the land of Babylon. Abraham is saved out of Babylon. You know, when Daniel's carried off to Babylon, it says they trained him in the language of the Chaldeans. Daniel and the Jewish nation were carried off to the land that Abraham was saved out of. And so, and I always like to remind people that the three patriarchs, and this will come up later in our study, the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, where did Abraham find Sarah? In Israel or in Chaldea, Babylon? And he brings her to the promised land. So time for Isaac to get a wife. Where does Abraham send Eliezer? Back to Mesopotamia, to the land of the Chaldeans. And he gets Rebekah, and he brings her back. Then it comes time for Jacob to get a wife. Where does he go? Back across the Euphrates, to Chaldea. Brings her out of Babylon into the promised land. Years later, the children of Israel are carried to Babylon. That's his bride. And he saves his people. He brings them out of Babylon back to the promised land. Now you get to Revelation. And he says, Babylon has fallen. Come out of her, my people. God calls his bride out of Babylon into the ultimate promised land. So there's a theme that you see going. You see what I'm talking about? All the way through the Bible.
Exodus 22.
You about Cal?
I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt.
Yeah, well, God, yeah, he brought them out of Egypt when they're in that captivity. I'm talking about where he brought Abraham. Behind every great man stands a woman telling him that he's wrong. Okay.
Doug, just a question.
Yeah, Terry.
At what time was everybody keeping the Sabbath?
All right, question is, I'd like to repeat for our friends watching. At this point, was everyone keeping the Sabbath? I believe that God's people were. Now, the reason is that Genesis 25, where it says, Abraham kept my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. Forget the verse. And so God, and this is before the Ten Commandments, God says Abraham was keeping the laws of God. So we're assuming that would encompass the Sabbath because it goes all the way back to creation. All right, going on here. So this is very important. I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to inherit it. And he said, Lord, how shall I know that I will inherit it? So he said to him, bring me a three-year-old heifer. And God asks him to do something that may seem odd to us. Bring me a three-year-old heifer, a three-year-old female goat, a three-year-old ram. Now these domestic animals are all in their prime. So he brings out a cow, a goat, a female, a male goat, and he said, a turtle dove and a young pigeon. This really was covering the spectrum of offerings. The very poor would bring doves. You remember when Mary and Joseph came, they were very poor. When they came to make an offering for Jesus when he was born and he was named and circumcised, they brought turtle doves, and that's all the poor could bring. Middle class would bring a sheep. The wealthy would bring an oxen or a cow. And you couldn't offer anything bigger. Can't offer a camel. You know, they were unclean. And so this is from the spectrum of offerings that they had back then. And so God is getting ready, basically, to seal the covenant with a blood sacrifice. And he's basically saying, take one of everything, so there's no doubt. And he said he brought them, he sacrificed them, he cut them in two, down the middle, placed each piece opposite the other, but he did not cut the birds in two. And when the vultures came down on the carcasses, Abraham drove them away. Now, Abraham's done what he said, but usually when you make an offering, it's a burnt offering. But now he's been told to sacrifice these. They're laying on the ground. See, God always kept the temple clean. As soon as something was sacrificed, everything was burned and carried off. Nothing stayed there to decompose. There were no, Josephus says there were no flies in the temple. Isn't that interesting? And I'm not sure that was true when Jesus chased the animals out, but during the sacrificial period. When the vultures came down on the carcass, Abraham drove them away. Does he ever have the vultures come down on your faith? Now, when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, horror and great darkness. He's having a vision, but it's a frightening vision, fell upon him. And he, God, said to Abram, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. Now let's pause here. Here God is giving a prophecy to Abraham that we've watched be fulfilled in the Exodus, that the children of Israel would be carried down into Egypt, and it says they'd be there 400 years. Now when you study the Exodus, from the time that Jacob goes until Moses comes out with a nation, it's like 240 years or something. It's not 400 years. So the 400 years really begins counting from when Ishmael begins to persecute Isaac. And that's the way I've seen that verse described. It's the only way you can match it. If you ever look at the genealogies in Chronicles, you'll notice that you very quickly go from Levi, son of Jacob, to his son Gershom, and then you get Jochebed and the father of Moses, Amram, and then Moses. It's like you get four generations. It goes very quickly. So they weren't in Egypt 400 years. He's saying that there would be a time of persecution that would start and last 400 years. And then he would call the people out. And it says, in the nation whom they serve, I will judge. Did he judge Egypt? Afterward, they will come out with great possessions. It says they spoiled the Egyptians. And it says all the Egyptians were giving objects of silver and gold to the Israelites, saying, please leave and bless us. And it says they came out with great substance. Now this also happened to Abraham. Do you remember when Abraham took Sarah in a previous chapter down to Egypt during a famine? Said, she's not my wife, she's my sister. And then a plague fell on Pharaoh. And then Pharaoh sent him out and gave him gifts. It's like history's repeating itself. He said, what happened to you, Abraham, when Pharaoh tried to take your wife? I cursed him because that's the apple of my eye. Now what is the church? It's the bride of Christ, the apple of his eye. When the Pharaoh, later of Exodus, persecutes God's bride, doesn't he visit Egypt with terrible judgments? And then they come out with great wealth, and Egypt is at that point decimated. Now, as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. Now, did God look upon the saved fathers of Abraham as dead or resting? He's talking about them like they're living. It's not like they're gone. And how can Abraham inherit the promised land where he is a stranger living in a tent? How does he ultimately inherit the promised land unless there's a resurrection? You know, the Bible says that Moses looked for a city that had foundations whose builder and maker is God. So when Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Moses, when they were looking to inherit the promised land, did Moses ever go to the promised land? Moses lived a long time and he covered a lot of ground. Egypt, Midian, wilderness, back to Egypt, made it to the borders of the promised land. He only saw it in vision before he died. But is Moses going to be in the promised land? Because when the New Jerusalem comes down, where does it sit? A Mount of Olives in the middle of the promised land. Abraham is going to be there. He's not going to be in a tent anymore. He'll probably have some of the best real estate. You know, if you play Monopoly, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they get Park Place and Broadway. And so they're going to have a permanent dwelling in the promised land. And he was looking for that. He said, you'll go to be with your fathers in peace, and you'll be buried at a good old age. Now, sometimes we don't feel like old age and good go together, right? But Abraham lived 175. But in the fourth generation, they will return here. Fourth generation from when this persecution begins. From the fourth generation, they will return here. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Amorites was a word that was sort of a generic word to describe the people that lived in the land of Canaan. And God said, you know, at that point you're going to come and you're going to punish them. And it came to pass when the sun went down and it was dark, that behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a burning torch that passed between those pieces. Now, how does God show that he accepts a covenant? When Abel made an offering, it says God accepted Abel's offering. How did God accept his offering? Fire very likely came down, though it does not say that there. But the reason we believe that is because when Moses set up the sanctuary, what happened? Fire came down. When Solomon dedicated his temple, you read in Chronicles, fire came down. When Elijah built his sacrifice, show his approval, what happened? Fire came down. Now, Abraham has made a sacrifice. Finally, God sends the fire. And as that fire moves among the pieces, the commentators I've read said it was probably consuming them because sacrifices were never left for the birds of carrion, as you can see. And so what God is doing is he's basically saying, I'm sealing this sacrifice. I'm accepting the sacrifice. I'm making a covenant with you now that I will give you a son, that I will give you this land, that your children will be like the stars of heaven. Yeah.
Just a quick thought on that. I also read somewhere that back in Bible times when they performed this type of a covenant and they separated the animals, cut them in pieces and so on, it was also testifying that if I break the covenant, you can do to me what you did to the animals. In essence, God is saying, if I break my covenant to you, in essence, I'm putting my life on the line.
And that that's good.
Illustrated in that form of the covenant. So God's, in essence, saying, I promise you, I'm putting my life on the line that this is going to be, I'm going to fulfill.
That makes sense. I also read that God makes this pillar of fire pass among the sacrifices right after he talks about the children of Israel being in the wilderness or their persecution. And some said it's a symbol of the fiery trials that his people were going to go through, but he would bring them through it. And there was a pillar of fire in the wilderness. So it's sort of mysterious to us because our customs are a little different today. You usually don't, you know, take a turtle dove with you when you go sign a contract these days in the lawyer's office. But this is how they made their blood covenants. And then God reiterates on verse 18, it says that the fire passed between those pieces. And on the when I read this, passed between the pieces also can mean it passed over the pieces that had been separated and consumed them. And on the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land from the river Euphrates to the river of Egypt, to the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, the Jebusites. Now, do you notice something different here? When the children of Israel finally do come into the promised land, God says, I'll give you victory over these seven nations. How many nations did I just read? 10. I won't make you count them. And so you might wonder, why is that different? Well, because in the time that passed between Abraham and Moses, some of these nations blended into one. They intermarried and they sort of became one nation. So you end up with seven by the time the Exodus takes place. All right, we're going to keep going, see how far along we are. This gets very interesting now. Any questions on chapter 15? Well, Terry?
Doug, was it always fire from heaven that burnt the sacrifices?
Was it always fire from heaven that burnt the sacrifices? No. During the wilderness time, they would kindle the fire on the altar. Well, originally God brought fire down on the altar. It was called holy fire because God kindled the original fire. They were always supposed to keep that fire going. It got real cold the last few days. Karen and I have a fireplace. We started a fire. We kept it going. We never had to bring out another match for about 4 days. We were using the original fire. Well, for hundreds of years, going through the wilderness, they always kept the fire burning that God had originally kindled from the sanctuary. You ever seen the cemetery with an eternal flame? That whole concept kind of comes back from God igniting the fire. But later on, they would light the fires. By the time of Jesus, by the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, no record that the fire came down from heaven. They'd have to light it. They'd have a sacred service. They'd light it, and then they'd call it holy fire. So, all right, moving to chapter 16. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. And she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. Now, Hagar is a very Jewish word, and it's believed that she was renamed by Abraham and his family. She probably had, you know, one of those Egyptian names. You ever try to pronounce Joseph's Egyptian name? Zaphath-Paneah, whatever it is. It's kind of hard. So they gave her a Hebrew name, and the interesting thing is the Hebrew name word Hagar means stranger or sojourner. They said, well, you've been sojourning with us. probably when Pharaoh, remember when Pharaoh evicted Abraham and Sarah from Egypt because he lied about their relationship, he also gave Abraham gifts, and it says he gave him maidservants and manservants. A lot of people believe this is when Hagar was gifted to Sarah. So she had an Egyptian. She's still young. She's not married. Your servants could marry each other and have children. So they probably picked her. She was probably bright and attractive and had some promise because Sarah's thinking, she's going to be a surrogate mother for me. You want good stock. And so Sarah was feeling, she saw Abraham was moping around because he had no children. And he's thinking, I guess Eliezer's going to be my heir. What am I going to do now? And several years had gone by from the time God made this promise, and Abraham's faith is being tested. Patience. And you've heard the expression, good things come to those that wait. My father used to say, good things come to those that hustle. But I think Benjamin Franklin said, good things come to those that wait. And Abraham, evidently his faith was being tested, and he started losing patience. And where did I read that? Oh, that's in my other notes here, yeah. Patience is a virtue. Possess it if you can. Found seldom in a woman, never in a man. And evidently they both lost patience. And Sarah thought, well, we'll just take things into our own hands. We're going to help God along. You ever try and help God? How did that end up? Yeah, you ever seen your kids give each other a haircut? Kind of looks like they got mange. Sometimes we try to use the devil's tools to do God's work. And I remember the Bible tells a story about King Asa was being attacked. And God had given him victory before, but instead of turning to God the second time, he hired mercenaries from Assyria, and God said, why didn't you turn to me? You're trying to use the devil's tools to do my work. Now, I'm paraphrasing. It's not what God said. So now, there's no record in the Bible of any polygamy where there wasn't contention. Isn't that interesting? I actually have had phone calls, Pastor Ross and I, on the radio program, where men call. I've never heard a woman call. But men have called, and they try to actually argue that the Bible supports multiple wives. And the scripture I always use, they say, there's no scripture. I say, yes, there is. The Bible says no man can serve two masters. But though I think there is scripture other than that. But every example of polygamy in the Bible ended badly. You look at the wives of Solomon, it didn't go well. The wives of David, it didn't go well. You look at Jacob and how they all fought. Look at Elkanah with Peninnah and Hannah, one tormenting the other. It just was not God's plan. He made it clear at the beginning what the plan was, and it was Adam and Eve. It isn't until I think Lamech, one of the descendants of Cain, comes along and it says he had wives and it names his two wives. Up until that point, it was all monogamy. Someone asked the boy, what they said, what is marriage? Some kid in Sunday school, he said, it's holy monotony. He meant to say matrimony, but he got mixed up. So, she had a maid named Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, you notice it's not Sarah and Abraham yet. Sarai said to Abram, see now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Now, what Sarah does is later repeated by both Leah and Rachel. They think either I haven't had any children or I'm not having any more children, and so they're competing, and they give their handmaids to Jacob. And it just brings all kinds of contention. And if you want to read something funny, I very seldom recommend anything that is like extra biblical reading. But Mark Twain writes an account where, do you know Mark Twain, actually his name was Samuel Clemens, he went with his brother was the secretary of Nevada. He was the governor of Nevada. And Mark Twain He was the secretary of Nevada, and Mark Twain went with him to Nevada, and he on his way across, he stopped in Utah, and he spent a day or two with Brigham Young. And he talks about the chaos in Brigham Young's house with all the wives. It is a very funny piece. He talks about the contention and the chaos. You know, Mark Twain is funny when it isn't funny, but it was really funny. Anyway, so this is never God's plan, and it never ends well. The Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perchance I might obtain children by her. And Abraham heeded the voice of Sarai. Then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband. Now, the reason it says it like that is when you live in a big encampment and you're a big nomadic sheik and you've got hundreds of servants, maybe even thousands in his household, he had 300 that fought. So he's maybe got, you know, a couple thousand people in his household. Nothing's a secret. And if all of a sudden one morning Hagar should walk out of Abraham's tent, it would have been a scandal. So publicly, Sarah did, which wasn't that uncommon in those days, when a woman couldn't bear children, they thought it's important. He had borne long waiting. He's now like 75 or something. And she publicly takes the hand of Hagar, puts it in the hand of Abraham in front of everybody, saying, you know, she's going to be a concubine so he can have children. And everyone sort of shrugs, I understand. That happened back then. So that's why it's worded that way. So he goes in to Hagar, and she conceives. And when she saw that she'd conceived, her mistress became despised. So how long does it take for the contention to begin? Now Hagar, all of a sudden, her status changes. You know, she's a slave in Egypt, and she's handed over by the Pharaoh to this stranger. She's got to learn a new language. And she's serving Sarai, and she's, you know, she's a servant. She submits to Sarai. They were your property back then. I'm not telling you it was right or wrong. I'm just telling you that's the way it was. And she says, one morning, Hagar, I got news for you. Abraham's having, you know, a challenge having children through me, so I'm going to let you be one of his concubines. Well, she kind of thinks that might be a promotion in the family. Maybe my status will go up, might get a pay raise. I don't know what she's thinking. And then she gets pregnant. She thinks, I'm the mother of the king's, because Abraham's the king in his family, of the king's baby. And now Sarah says, hey, you know, go wash the dishes. She's going, what do you mean, wash the dishes? Abraham, you know, you can't take a woman in your arms without feeling some fondness. He's got to start feeling a little different towards Hagar, too. And Sarah now all of a sudden is jealous. What did she expect? And so the relationship right away goes south. When she saw that she conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes, because now Sarah's ordering around. She's, wait, I'm a wife too. And Sarai said to Abraham, my wrong be upon you. Now, does that sound like a lot of our homes? My wrong be upon you. Whose idea was this? Let's read back a few verses. I gave my maid into your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between you and me. It's your fault. You're the man. You should have stopped me. Maybe that's what she's saying. She was right. And Abraham said to Sarai, indeed, your maid is in your hand. She says, I never said she wasn't your servant anymore. Do as you please. And when Sarai dealt harshly with her, I don't know if that just meant that she was yelling at her. I don't know if she took up a rope and beat her. I don't know what that means, but she started to chastise her in some way for her insolence. Hagar stopped submitting. Now, she was a servant. She never stopped being a servant, but she stopped submitting to Sarah. Maybe she was being a little bold and proud herself. And it says when she dealt harshly with her, Hagar fled from her presence. Now, evidently, she goes out into the wilderness. And the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, and by a spring on the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar. Now, who is this angel of the Lord that finds Hagar? You've got to feel it's probably the Lord, Jesus. In other places where it says the angel of the Lord, it's often what you would call a Christophany. In the Old Testament, when Christ appeared before the incarnation, he is sometimes identified as the angel of the Lord. You know, Moses said, or God said to Moses, "The Lord your God will raise up a prophet unto you like me, him you will hear." There is this prophet like Moses, and that was another prophecy about Jesus. But let me give you some examples in the Bible. When Jacob wrestled with the angel, later Jacob says, my eyes have seen the Lord. And this angel is the one who pronounces the blessing on Jacob. When the angel of the Lord appears to Manoah, and he makes an offering, they said, "What is your name?" He said, "Why do you inquire after my name? It is wonderful." What's one of the names for Jesus? Isaiah, "His name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God." When the angel of the Lord appears to Joshua, Joshua says, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" He says, "No, but as captain of the Lord's army I am come." And he says, "Take the shoes off of your feet, for this is holy ground." And Joshua worships him. Now, are we supposed to worship angels? Revelation 19, John tries to worship an angel. The angel says, "Get up, don't do it. Don't worship anyone but God." So if there's an angel that you're supposed to pray to, that's Christ. Angel means messenger. Don't always think cherub or seraphim. And so this may have been Christ himself. The angel of the Lord finds her by a spring of water in the wilderness, and by a spring on the way to Shur, and he says, "Hagar, Sarai's maid, where have you come from and where are you going?" Now, God asks rhetorical questions. Is it because he doesn't know? Or what did God say to Adam? "Where are you?" Had God misplaced Adam? He couldn't find him anymore? Why does the Lord say, "Where are you?" When Jesus asked the apostles there in the upper room, "What were you talking about on the road, by the way?" Did he know what they were talking about? They're arguing which of them was the greatest. So when God asks these questions, it's not because he doesn't know. He's trying to just get them to think. And so he said, "Where are you going? Are you going to run off? You can run back to Pharaoh? Where are you going?" He's basically saying. And "Where'd you come from?" She said, "I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai." Now, she had just said that Sarah was the female equivalent of a master, a mistress. And the angel said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit yourself under her hand." Now, why did God say that? Because later, Abraham is told to basically divorce Hagar. Did you know that? The word that's used, and I know I'm getting ahead with either something I'll teach later, one of the other pastors, but when contention becomes unbearable, God tells Abraham, "Listen to Sarai and put away," it's the word that's used for divorce, "Hagar." She's sent away. She's given some gifts and sent away. But now God's telling her to go back. It was important that Ishmael be born in the family, reared and trained and influenced by Abraham to worship Jehovah. If Hagar had left, she might have gone to Egypt, and Ishmael, the seed of Abraham, would have been raised polytheistic. I mean, we don't know. But for this time, God had promised that this child would still be blessed. Hagar had learned about the true God. Ishmael ultimately is raised believing in the true God. Even the Muslims of the world are monotheistic. They practice circumcision. That goes all the way back to Abraham. So there's a connection with what's happening here. And the angel said to her, "Return to your mistress, submit yourself to her." Then the angel of the Lord said to her, "I will multiply your descendants exceedingly, so they shall not be counted for multitude." And the angel of the Lord said to her, "Behold, you are with child, and you will bear a son, and you will call his name." Now, those words appear somewhere else? Does an angel some other time come and say, "You're going to have a son, and you're going to name him"?
Jesus.
Happens with Mary. Does the angel tell Zechariah what to name John the Baptist? Yeah. Now, in particular here with Jesus, this Ishmael is a son of Abraham named by God. In a sense, he's a type of Christ that would later come as a son of Abraham named by God. But there's a big difference between the seed of Hagar and the seed of Sarah. You go to Galatians in the New Testament, or is it Galatians or Romans, where Paul talks about Hagar is assigned to Mount Sion, Paul basically says Hagar represents righteousness by law and works, where when Sarah gets pregnant later, it represents righteousness by faith. Sarah gives birth because of a promise, and it's a miracle. It's a miracle birth of God. Whereas Sarah and Abraham with Hagar, they try to do it man's way. Yes?
Sure sounds like predestination.
What does it sound like? Predestination. Well, has God preordained some things?
Yeah, but in people,
we each get to make a choice. So when God foretells the future of Ishmael, is it because God is making Ishmael do certain things or because God knows what he's going to choose?
He's not the seed. So, I don't know.
Well, God, you know what God often does? A lot of things are not God's original will, but then he works with the decisions that we make. It was not God's will that Sarah give Hagar to Abraham. But then when it happens, he makes the best of it for everybody. You know, it's interesting. Let me just give you an example of that. Jacob has four wives. We're talking about who is the first wife that Jacob sleeps with?
Leah.
Who is the one that Jesus comes through? Leah. Who is the one that is buried with Jacob in the cave of Machpelah? Leah. None of the other three. It's almost like God had said, this was my plan for you. You kept, you know, you had your own plans. Karen doesn't like that.
She was beautiful and she could see.
And she stole her father's gods. And then lied. Yeah.
Is there some time in our history when we, because now if I listen to what I'm hearing tonight, then you can have all the wives you want, it sounds like.
All right, so Terry's asking, can he have all the wives he wants?
No. But I mean, it wasn't.
No. Well, all right, let's talk about that for just a second. Is it Acts 17:32? The times of this ignorance God winked at. There's a lot of things that happened before that God did not approve of. Does God make laws? No, you found the verse about Hagar in
Galatians 4,
yeah. That talks about Hagar and Sarai represent two kind of pictures of salvation, one by works and one by faith. But back to the question on God winking at ignorance. Was it ever God's plan for people to have slaves? Was it ever God's plan for there to be divorce? Jesus said to the apostles, why did Moses give us a law on divorce if it's not God's plan? He said, because of the hardness of your hearts, God allowed it. Was it ever God's plan for us to eat meat? God said, because of the hardness of your arteries, I am allowing it. But it was never his original plan. So he made laws. He said, if you're going to eat it, here's the law. He said, if you're going to make slaves out of each other, you must protect the slaves. So there are laws about that. He said, if you're going to have more than one wife, God made laws about being fair to both wives. It doesn't mean he approved of it. He often made laws to accommodate bad things that they were doing and so that there would be some fairness there. Yeah.
But it was never God's will that Israel have a king.
That's right.
When they chose a king, he gave certain guidelines as to what the king was to do.
That's exactly right, yeah. Matter of fact, even before they chose a king, Moses said, when you get into your land, if you pick a king. And so God foretold they would do it, but he said, I wanted to be your king. You're the ones who said you didn't want me to be your king anymore. So there's a lot of things where God winks at our ignorance. He's patient. How many of you are glad God's patient and he works things out for good when you make bad mistakes? Yeah, we wouldn't have a chance. That's right. It wasn't that way. All right, well, I got to keep moving here, or we're not going to get Ishmael born. So, he says, behold, you're with child. I'm in Genesis chapter 16, verse 11. Behold, you're with child, and you'll bear a son, and you'll call his name Ishmael. Now, Ishmael's name is not that different from Samuel. It means God hears. She's out there by herself. She's praying. God heard her prayer because the Lord has heard. See, the name Ishmael is connected with the word heard. The Lord has heard your affliction. He will be, now here's a prophecy about him. He will be a wild man. Now God is not saying he's going to make him wild. He says, I'm going to tell you how he's going to end up. He'll be a wild man. Now this, for one thing, means a man in the wilderness. Well, later says he became an archer. He's a hunter. He was sent away from Abraham, and he ended up going up into what they called the Arabah. Now, do you know the word Arabia? The Arabah was the wilderness, but it wasn't all desert back then, because Job lived in the Arabah, and he had a lot of cattle and sheep, and it was more pasture lands back then, a wilderness. And but you've heard of desertification. The desert's kind of spreading. It's always fascinating to me that if you go to northern Africa in the Sahara, there are places in the Sahara where there's petroglyphs, rock paintings that some of the men made, and they got hippos and crocodiles and elephants, and they show all these reed animals and water. It's out in the middle of the desert right now, but there used to be water there. Well, the promised land used to be more promised than it is now, and it was more promising. And the weather and the climates have changed a little bit, and it's because they started driving cars. It just totally ruined the whole place. So he said, he will be a wild man, and his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And, you know, I was reading some historical comments on the history of the Arabs, and they often lived in tribes for thousands of years. When others forged into nations, they were tribes, and they fought among themselves, and anyone who passed through, they taxed them, they raided them. And they really kind of did live in the wilds in a wild way and learned how to survive in what slowly became a very hostile environment, because it happened slowly. They adapted and they learned how to live out in that harsh land. And he will dwell in the presence of his brethren. Now, this is interesting. Their clan stayed together. And when Ishmael finally dies, many chapters later, it says he died, quote, in the presence of his brethren. And he lived well over 100 years of age. So she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, "You are the God who sees. And have I also here seen him who sees me?" That's interesting. "Here I have seen him who sees me." Now, how often had he seen her? All her life. She finally realized, he sees me when I pray. And that's a good thing for all of us to recognize. Therefore, the well was called Beer-shal-lehi-roi. Observe it between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram named his son, whom Hagar bore, Ishmael. Now, where do you think Abraham got the name? Don't you think Hagar came home and told him, "An angel appeared to me and said, this is what you're to name the boy"? So this name came from God. He named him Ishmael. Abraham was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abraham. How old is he when Isaac is born? About 100. And so at that point, Ishmael is about 13 or 14, depending on what month it was. So I just wanted to make a note of the 86 here, because that comes up later. Well, this is, I hope you learned something tonight. I want to thank our friends who were studying with us online. And we'll look forward to seeing you join us again here at the Granite Bay Bible Study next week. We're going to have our closing prayer with our church family here. And we'll sign off until next time. God bless you.